Don't we always? He proceeded out the door with her to implement Operation Dinner, as Sizer Pretoria, still dripping from the thawed sleet, handed me a sandwich and a styrofoam cup of coffee. I called in and Marie said she could put Antonio down on her own. She also said that NOAA reports we've got a heller of an ice storm coming in. Going to last the entire weekend. Any time now, it's supposed to turn from sleet to frozen rain and then snow by morning. He folded the wrapper down and placed his paperback on the table. There was a red, cellophane-flagged toothpick in his sandwich that he extracted and pointed toward me. By the way, you're in trouble. I broke my reverie of white buffaloes and thought about my more personal problems.
Henry or Vic?
Both.
I'm in trouble, I considered. Can I borrow your cell phone?
He handed the device over, and I watched as he began devouring his food. He spoke through the bacon, lettuce, and tomatoes. Just hit send. They're at her house. I punched the green button, held the phone to my ear, and waited. There was an immediate answer. Fucker!
I sighed. It's not my fault.
She remained silent. Did Sizer Pretoria explain? I glanced up, and the Basco nodded. I made my Uncle Al's lasagna, Rustica. Do you know how long that takes?
I'm sorry.
The Cheyenne Nation, your dog, and I are all drinking wine and talking about what a shit you are.
Dog is drinking wine?
She exhaled audibly. Well, I poured him some. So far he's just looking at it. There was a long pause on the line. Sancho said it was something to do with the feds.
A body?
Yep, and we caught the jurisdiction. I sighed again. 7-year-old boy, almost a decade deceased. But there's a very big twist. The victim's name is Owen White Buffalo. I glanced up and could see the Basco's dark eyes grow enormous, and he stopped chewing. I nodded to him briefly and then listened to the phone. It was by far the longest pause yet, and her voice sounded strained.
You're shitting me.
I wish I was. Her pitch softened a little with the wonder of our predicament. What does this have to do with the prisoner transport?
One of them may have been involved with the murder in a primary way.
I listened as she readjusted the phone.
The shade guy?
Yep.
Figures. The voices in that fucker's head are singing Barbershop. It was quiet, and I listened to her breathe. Here's Henry. You better talk to him. I could hear her hand him the phone, and my lifelong buddy came on the line, a man with whom I'd endured the Wyoming public school system and Vietnam.
You are in trouble.
More than you'll ever know. I explained the situation. Do you have any idea if any of the White Buffaloes had any children who might have disappeared about 9 years ago? I waited as he absorbed it all. I tried not to mention the 400-pound Indian in the room. Can you make some phone calls?
Yes.
Do you still have Eli's number over in Hot Springs?
I do.
Could you check with him and then call me back here on Sancho's cell? There was talk in the background, and Henry spoke again.
She wants to know if you have eaten.
I stared at the sandwich that was still wrapped on the table in front of me. Not yet, so tell her to save me some lasagna. There was more talk, but I interrupted. Hey, Henry?
Yes.
Have you had any contact with Virgil since last summer?
I will ask Vic to save you some lasagna.
Virgil White Buffalo was briefly a suspect in a homicide case we had last August. McGroder, trying to get a read on why I was telling him all this, studied me as he ate his turkey sandwich.
Uh-huh. He wasn't guilty, but he did display a number of antisocial characteristics and is at large.
The Basco stated flatly, in more ways than one. McGroder glanced at Sancho and then back at me. What the hell does that mean?
He's a very big man.
The Utah agent studied me. Bigger than you?
Much.
I took my hat off and balanced it on my knee. In our part of the world, he's what some people refer to as an FBI. Sancho provided the translation. Fucking big Indian. McGroder stopped chewing.
Dangerous? He has had his moments.
The agency man set his sandwich down. Let me get this straight. You've got a giant Indian sociopath running around in these mountains who may be related to our victim? I noticed he'd lost the politically correct sobriquet.
I'm checking on that, and besides, he may not be anywhere near here. All we have are rumors. The Cloud Peak Wilderness area alone is 189,039 acres, and it's completely surrounded by the Bighorn National Forest. So the chances of running into him, or of him knowing anything about your investigation, are slim. I drank some of my coffee and listened to my stomach complain about waiting for the lasagna. We didn't know about the investigation until a few hours ago. McGroder sat there looking at his half-eaten sandwich, his appetite having just taken a hit. I don't like coincidences. I'm not too fond of them myself, but I thought it was information you should have. Thank you. His hand came up and covered most of his face. There's another concern. He looked at me through his fingers. There is. Have you guys checked the weather recently? The agent glanced out the window with a glum expression. It's shitty. Why? We both watched as the waitress pulled her aged SUV from the lot and turned left, driving carefully onto Route 16. I assumed she was done for the night and heading home the 20 miles to Tensleep, where she probably lived. It may get worse. The temperature is dropping, and in an hour or so this whole mountain range is going to be encased in a couple of inches of ice. McGroder sighed, and I continued. There aren't any working facilities open in any of the lodges around here, so you're going to have to haul your people back to South Fork Lodge. I think you should secure the scene and get the rest of these prisoners off the mountain. He plucked the Motorola from his hip and clicked the mic. AT, when can you be ready to go? After a moment, a strong signal came back from the van in the parking lot. Static. Can we eat first? He glanced at me, and I spread my hands. McGroder clicked the mic again. As soon as you're done, get out of here. He rested the radio on the table and looked at me. 600 and some miles back to Salt Lake? 650 miles from Durant. About 8 hours in good weather. We both looked out the windows again, which you are not going to have until you descend a couple thousand feet. My eyes stayed on the Department of Corrections van holding Renault's shade. One of the marshals was proffering bags of food to Benton, who divided it and handed some to the prisoner.
What about him?
He stays. McGroder sipped his coffee. But there's no reason that you have to. If I had a warm bed and hot lasagna an hour away, I'd be leaving skid marks.
I glanced at my deputy, who was making a pretense of reading, and probably anxious to get home to his wife and young son.
You're sure you don't need us?
In about 20 minutes I'm going to have a mobile task force of 2 field agents and 4 marshals to guard only one man.
He stood and extended his hand.
I think we can handle it. Would you mind borrowing one of our vehicles so that we can keep him in yours?
I placed my hat back on my head and reared up into a standing position.
I could see the relief on Sancho's face as McGroder handed me a set of keys.
It was nice that I hadn't had to remind him that even though it was his investigation, it was still my county.
When do you want us back at the scene?
Weather permitting, probably early in the morning, say 0800.
We shook hands, and I stared at his crew cut again.
Semper Fi? He grinned.
Yeah, you?
I picked up my coffee and put the lid back on.
First Division.
Wearing a pasted-on smile, he slapped me on the shoulder.
Get some sleep, Sheriff. I'll see you at South Fork in the morning.
He stretched a hand toward Sizer Victoria, but looked at the both of us.
Thanks for your help, Deputy. If I don't see you again and you're ever over Salt Lake Way, look me up. I'll get you over to the pie for a good pizza.
As we got ready to go, he picked up my wrapped sandwich and tossed it to me.
Something for the road?
Class act.
Yep.
I was contemplating the sandwich in my lap and wondering if I could eat it now and the lasagna later. The Basco momentarily slid the borrowed Suburban into a turn, then carefully corrected and straightened.
Slick?
He nodded, but kept his concentration on the road.
Like greased goose shit.
Better slow down.
He heeded my unneeded advice, and we rolled, slid along the road at 45.
You think the shade guy did it?
Well, he all but admitted to it when I took him to the bathroom.
I thought about the adopted Crow Indian we'd passed on our way to the borrowed federal vehicle. He'd been eating while Benton, still holding the shotgun, watched. The marshal had nodded to us as we'd walked by in the freezing sleet. But it was Renault Shade's eye, the glass one, that seemed to track along with us as we passed. The thing was wayward at best, and it was probably just another reflection, but it was as if the dead eye was watching me. What? I turned to look at the Basco. Hmm? He continued to study me. You were thinking of something? I fiddled with the waxed paper. Did you read the file on Shade? No. He was one of the last of the Tukuthkuchin tribe up in Canada, Northwest Territories. I refolded the sandwich and stared out the window. Transferred from one of the residential boarding schools to a private orphanage when he was 8. They tested him, and his IQ was off the chart. Renault ran away to live with his non-Indian father, who took responsibility for him. 2 years later, a social worker stopped in to check on the boy and discovered that the father had died 8 months earlier. Sancho stared ahead. What did you do, commit the file to memory? I thought about it, about the parts I wasn't telling. That 10-year-old boy had been living in a cabin with his dead father in the bedroom for 8 months. He got kicked around to a number of foster homes before being adopted by a couple in Lodge Grass. The woman was Cree, her husband Crow. She was related to Shade's mother, but there were problems, behavioral and otherwise. He ended up dropping out of school. That must have been the period when he killed Owen White Buffalo. And who knows who else? He returned to Canada and joined the army up there. Dwyer Hill Training Center outside Ontario. Sancho reached down and turned the defrosters to full, and I watched the already ice-encased tree line as we passed, the conifers looking like some gigantic army standing at attention along both sides of the road. He was married, and his wife disappeared during a camping trip. There was a provincial hunt in Ontario, but she never turned up. Must have killed her, too. A year later, one of Shade's buddies went missing, and the Ottawa Police Department started asking some questions. The military stonewalled it, but Shade was drummed out. He turned up as a suspect again in Factory Island Reservation, Ontario, in a search for an outfitting business partner a couple of years later. He was arrested, and when they searched his apartment, they discovered blood trace from the guy he killed. Jesus! I pulled my cup from the holder and sipped my coffee. They stuck him in Kingston Penitentiary, but he got transported to a psychiatric prison for observation, and after 3 months there he escaped into the U.S., hid out up in Lodge Grass, and killed the old couple that had taken him in when he was a child. Sizer Vittoria shook his head as we slid around another sweeping corner. He's supposedly a very interesting case. A specific form of psychotic schizophrenic, where the subject is overcome by a culture-bound syndrome and hears voices. Sees. I couldn't help but pause. Sees apparitions. He refers to them as the seldom seen, and believes that he's actually possessed by evil spirits that force him to sacrifice others. Sounds like the old Basque priest at the Catholic Church who believes in fairies. I nodded. The versions vary from tribe to tribe, but these spirits are purported to be malicious, supernatural beings. The people they inhabit supposedly have malevolent spiritual powers, but are shunned by their own people. There was some chatter on the Fed's radio about the mobile unit coming down from Baby Wagon, and I was glad to hear it. The Basco slowed for another curve, and I could feel the Chevrolet fishtail. He glanced at me. You believe that stuff? I was just as glad that he hadn't been privy to my experiences in this very area of the mountains more than a year ago, when I had seen and heard my share of strange things. I believe there were spiritual signposts that these tribes put into place so that no matter how dire the situation, the members would never be tempted to do things the tribe considered absolutely taboo. I felt tired and slouched into the seat. Imagine beginning to see people, things that no one else can see. And in punishment, the real people around you begin drawing away, leaving you to these spirits. Isn't that kind of like pitting the monsters of your imagination against the monsters of human nature? I smiled. You have been reading your Dante. I stared out the side window and wasn't smiling when I made the next statement. wonder who would win. At the next bend, I could see a few dusk-to-dawn lights over the cabins that comprised South Fork. I want you to drop me off at the main lodge. I'll just stay up here tonight. He hunched his shoulders. You're going to be in even more trouble.
I know. I looked down at my lap. Could you call and tell them I won't be coming to dinner after all?
He glanced at me again as we gently slowed, listening to the sleet being thrown by the tires.
Why do you want to stay?
I just don't feel good about leaving those guys up here by themselves in this weather. He nodded and turned in the drive.
I'll stay too.
I looked at the headstrong Basco, at the same time thinking about the promise I'd made his wife a month back, about keeping him out of harm's way, even if harm was just keeping him up on the mountain for a night.
No, you won't. Go home.
He pulled the Suburban up to the porch at the front of the lodge, and we both peered through the windshield into the darkened windows. There were only a few lights on.
Looks like you might have to go down, too.
After a moment, though, Holly emerged from the kitchen, past the counter to the glass doors, and squinted in our headlights. She pulled on a coat, pushed open the door with an arm over her eyes, and shouted, "Can I help you?" I rolled down the window of the SUV and hung my head through. "Holly, it's me, Walt Longmire." She approached, wiping her hands on her jeans. "Hey, Sheriff." I shifted my hat back. The sleet smacked the ground around us like shrapnel.
"The feds call you?"
"About the food?"
"No, they're going to need beds up here for the night."
"Nope."
That was odd.
She stuffed her hands in her pockets, only to bring them out a moment later.
"How many?"
"About a half dozen, and one for a prisoner." She zipped her fleece over her stained apron and pulled up the collar.
"Unfortunately, I have rooms. A lot of my guests couldn't make it in."
"You have 7 plus 1?
"Who else?"
"Me." She looked past the hood of the Suburban to the cabin nearest the lodge.
"I can stick you in the hired hand's bunk. It's small, but it's got a single in it."
"That'll do, thanks." I pushed open the door and stepped out with the sandwich in my hands.
"Kitchen closed?"
She looked sheepish.
"I'm afraid so. Good thing you brought your own."
I began unwrapping it. "I'll wait up for the feds."
"That's okay, Walt. You get some sleep. I'll get Beatrice to do that, wherever she's gone off to."
Holly flipped a few fingers at Sizer Vittoria as I closed the door, and the Basco waved back, but he still sat there, parked. I thought about how I'd seen the waitress turning left as she got back on the main route. Last time we saw her, she was headed toward Ten Sleep. I took a bite of my movable feast.
"Well, damn it, I guess she decided to go home."
The club sandwich was good, and I was starved. I swallowed a bite and reached in the open window to retrieve my cup of lukewarm coffee from the holder on the dash. Maybe she misunderstood or got scared of the roads. The lodge owner nodded, not very happy with the situation. Sancho called out from the driver's seat,
"You sure you don't want me to stay?"
"I'm sure." I took another bite of my sandwich and backed away from the truck to allow the Basco to escape. I had taken a step back when I felt something in my mouth other than bread, turkey, bacon, lettuce, and tomato. I handed Holly my cup of coffee.
"Something wrong, Sheriff?"
I reached into my mouth and pulled out what I thought might have been one of the little flagged toothpicks that held the sandwich together, but instead found a bobby pin with one of the small cellophane flags attached. I held it up for both of us to see.
"Geez, Walt, I'm sorry."
Holly ran a hand through her thick hair.
"Not mine."
We both laughed, but the laughter died as I held the thin piece of metal up and could see that the protective tip had been removed from one end and that it had been bent into two opposite-facing right angles near the head, so that it looked like a key. Chapter 4. It had taken us only a few minutes to get going once we discovered the makeshift handcuff key, but it was taking an agonizingly long time to get back to Meadowlark Lodge. We'd run off the road 3 times already. I held the mic from the Fed's radio close to my mouth.
"Come in, Unit 1. This is Unit 2. Agent McGroder. This is Sheriff Longmire. Over."
Static. Sancho risked a look.
"This isn't good."
"No, it's not." I braced a hand against the dash as we made the turn at Powder River Pass on the Cloud Peak Skyway, almost 10,000 feet above sea level. The storm had gotten serious, and the sleet now pounded the top of the Fed Suburban like a snare drum. Sancho was doing his best, but the puddles of slush that pooled in the tread swales of the mountainous road made every turn feel as if we were attempting to corner an overloaded rowboat. I pulled out the Basco's cell phone, but there were no available bars. He glanced at me. Anything? Nope. I'd had Holly make the 911 call down the mountain with the landline she had in the lodge, but we weren't likely to get cell reception again until we got back to Meadowlark. Line of sight, or it could just be interference from the storm. Yeah, but they've also got those satellite phones, so somebody ought to be able to get through to them. I pressed the button on the mic again. Unit 1, this is Unit 2. How about it, McGroder? Over? I waited a second and then depressed the button again. Anybody? Static. Sancho gained a little speed on the straightaway as we sluiced past the cutoff to County Roads 422 and 419, where Shade had buried the remains of the boy. After a few minutes, we could see the lights of something in the gloom of the darkened sleet up ahead. Are those headlights? No, it's something else. As we got closer, we could see that the gas pumps at Meadowlark Lodge had exploded, billowing black smoke and flames into the sodden night. The Basco slowed and reverted to his mother tongue. Kiss me. We turned and continued down the sloped parking lot, and could see the reflection of the chemical bonfire in the lodge windows, and the melted sheen of the parking lot glowed in triplicate in the freezing fog. I kept thinking that if I looked at the images long enough, perhaps what they mirrored wouldn't be real. The Fed's other Suburban was lodged sideways into the pump island at a crazy angle, and we could see the still-burning bodies slumped in the driver and passenger seats. I drew the .45 from my holster, held onto the door handle, and nodded to the left of the Suburban. Over there! The Basco steered our vehicle toward the building, but a safe distance from the heat and flames. What if the tank on that thing goes?
It already has.
We slid to a stop, and I lurched from the SUV. Glancing at the flaming, T-boned Suburban, I extended my firing arm as I rushed toward the front door of the lodge, where I could see a body. The tactical yellow lettering across his shoulders bore the three letters. I was careful to walk around the blowback of what must have been the original shot and the trail of blood that he had made while trying to get to the main building. The blood was already frozen in the spot where he'd been gunned down, and it was probably the heat from the fire that had kept his body from freezing to the surface of the parking lot. He was still dragging himself toward the door. I could feel the pressure of the air moving toward the fire, creating a vortex that pulled the sleeting snow along the ground and back up into the flames before disappearing into the conflagration. I glanced toward the lodge windows, but it was only cursory. With the Department of Correction van missing, it was obvious where they, or, more important, Renault Shade, had gone. I placed a hand on McGroder's shoulder, and he stilled. Some of the air went out of him as I pulled him over. Double-aught buck, his thigh and the oblique muscles torn to shreds. His eyes didn't focus, and his lips hung open, but he was breathing. Michael? He gargled, and his throat pulled and constricted as the blood drained from the side of his mouth. His face contorted, and it took a moment for me to realize that he was trying to speak. Michael? With the surging noise of the fire and the continuing wind, I bent lower to hear his voice.
Where do...
He coughed, and more of the coagulated blood pushed out of his mouth.
Oh, hell.
Lie still and stop talking. I had to get him inside. With the lack of blood pressure and the cold, he would soon go into shock, if he hadn't already. I had to get him stabilized. I glanced at the Basco, who had approached the burning vehicle, braving the blown-out heat of the fire to check for survivors. Sancho! McGroder's eyes wandered, but then settled on me.
Who?
Walt Longmire, the sheriff, remember? It was textbook shock from blood loss. Sancho! A moment later he was beside me.
They're all dead.
McGroder's eyes remained unfocused, and the pupils began clicking back and forth like a metronome. He jolted at the statement,
"Oh, God!"
"Help me with him." We lifted the FBI agent as carefully as we could, with me taking his shoulders and Santiago his legs. I butted the glass door open with my back, and we laid McGroder on the bar to our left. I unzipped his jacket and pulled aside his shirt and thermal. The wound was gaping, but it didn't look as if it had gotten any of his organs, so we were just battling blood loss. There was a stack of bar towels under the counter, and I packed them into the wound in an attempt to staunch the bleeding. Hepatitis C be damned. The Basco returned from the back with a pile of wool army surplus blankets, folding one to place under the agent's head and then covering him with another three. Sancho tapped numbers into his cell phone, then snapped it shut in disgust, and grabbed Magruder's satellite phone from the floor where it had fallen from the table. The weather conditions must have screwed up the cell service. I lowered my face to the wounded man. "Michael, can you hear me?" I supported the side of his head with my hand. He swallowed.
"Procedure perfect."
"I'm sure."
"Don't know what happened."
I nodded. "They took our van?"
"Killed Benton and the other marshal. John Mooney, right off. Shot me before I could even get my... took my sidearm."
I nodded. "Was it Shade alone?"
"Yes."
He swallowed.
"He got Benton and Mooney in your DOC van. I heard the reporter ran out, but he was already standing there, and he shot me with the marshal's shotgun. He took my SIG, went inside, and got the keys from the table."
He tried to swallow again.
"Can I have something to drink?"
"Can do, buddy. The MTs are on the way." I leaned in closer. His eyes were clearing a little, and the focus was returning. "When did your other vehicle show?"
"Just as he was taking off in your van. He slammed into them and then unloaded on the driver, then the passenger. Pfaff was in there."
He sighed, a rattling gasp.
"Set the whole thing on fire with the pumps."
Sizer Pretoria appeared on the other side of the wounded man with the satellite phone still in his hands.
"Need to talk to you, boss."
I glanced back at Magruder. "You're going to be okay. Just rest easy, and we'll get you something to drink." I stepped around the bar toward the windows that still reflected the collective bonfires. "East Slope? Everybody's coming, but it's going to take forever. They've closed off the road. The whole east side at Powder River Pass is covered in ice, and they can only go maybe 15 miles an hour. I've alerted the DOJ and Marshal's offices. Henry and Vic are on their way with the EMTs and HPs."
"West Slope?"
"Joe Ironcloud's got 16 blocked along with 47 and 434. He's on his way up with Tommy Wayman, but it's already turned to snow west of here. We're going to get buried." I ran a quick topographic in my head. We were close to the spine that made up the Bighorn Mountains, and the majority of the precipitation would fall here before heading onto the plains. "Yep, we are." There was another surge of flame from the gas pumps, and even if the damn things were empty, they were liable to cause a continuing hazard. "Get him something to drink. I'm going to go out to the side of the building and find the cutoff to those pumps." Snow was just starting to mix with the sleet, and it was cold outside, colder than it had been when we'd arrived. Around the corner there was a lath fence beside the mudroom that housed a compressor and stacks of old tires, but in front of that there was an emergency kill switch. It was possible that, even empty, the pumps were still pushing gas vapor through the lines. After I threw the switch, the fire died down. Still keeping my distance, I returned to the front of the building and studied the burning suburban.